Welcome to Book Reporter Talks, where we're bringing you something different this week. I've been a longtime supporter of the Morristown Festival of Books. I was so happy 6 years ago when we had a book festival happening in New Jersey near my home after I've traveled the country going to festivals all over the place. So what we're going to be sharing with you today is one of the Morristown at Home virtual events that happened in February, where I interviewed Nadia Owusu, the author of Aftershocks. So I hope you enjoy this presentation that was previously taped, and make sure you mark your calendars for the Morristown Festival of Books events that will be happening on October 8th and 9th, 2021. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back, everyone. My name is Chad Lineweaver. I'm on the board of the Morristown Festival of Books, and I'm also the director of the Morristown and Morris Township Library. And welcome back to the Morristown Festival of Books at Home. Many of you joined us for our first event today, and we hope you enjoyed the conversation with the amazing and talented Kristen Hanna. We're incredibly excited to bring you debut author Nadia Owusu in our second session today. But as many of you know, the Morristown Festival of Books began in 2014 with the idea of bringing book lovers and authors together and engaging conversations in about a wide range of topics. But we've grown every year. We've had more attendees, more authors, and more great discussions. And we could not do this without all of your support, and certainly the support of the publishing community and all of our fabulous sponsors. We especially would like to thank Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management, the Community Foundation of New Jersey, Delta Dental, Investors Bank, Morris Arts, Red Hook Management Investment Advisors, and the William E. Simon Foundation for all of their generous support. While we missed getting together last October, this has given us an opportunity to explore a virtual event, which allows us to gather a broader audience from across the world. The need for great literature and conversation is now more critical than ever. And this event is the second one of four we'll host this weekend. We're delighted to host tomorrow David Michaelis and V.E. Schwab at 2 p.m. and 3:30 p.m. So please join us for those. I'm excited to present our moderator for our talk, Nadia Owusu, our longtime festival friend, Carol Fitzgerald. Carol is the president and founder of the Book Report Network, a group of websites about books and authors, including bookreporter.com and readinggroupguides.com. And Carol is known for her in-depth author interviews and has been a festival partner as well as a frequent festival moderator. Carol, we're thrilled to have you here, and I'm going to let you take it on from here.
Thank you so much, Chad. And I am so pleased to introduce Nadia Owusu. Nadia was born in Tanzania and was raised in Italy, Ethiopia, England, Ghana, and Uganda before moving to New York when she was 18. She's the recipient of the 2019 Whiting Award. Aftershocks, her first book, is a memoir that I'm so excited to share with you. I'm going to talk to her till about 4:10, at which time we're going to go to your questions. So down below in the Q&A is where you should be dropping your questions at this time. And thus, with no further ado, welcome, Nadia. So nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with your background that had you traveling the world before you were 18. Give us a glimpse of how that happened.
Sure. So my father worked for the United Nations World Food Program. And so his job was engaged with delivering food aid, largely in disastrous situations, so famine, war. And so we would move back and forth between headquarters in Rome, Italy, and different countries in Africa. That was sort of where he was largely focused in his work. And so that's what took me to Ethiopia and Uganda, England for boarding school for a while, high school, 2 years in Rome, as well as 4 years in Rome before that in elementary school. I had a very sort of nomadic childhood. My father was from Ghana, from the Ashanti tribe of Ghana, and my mother is Armenian American, and I have a Tanzanian stepmother, so a very international family and upbringing.
Yes, when we get together for dinner, it's like, who's bringing what? You know what I mean? Which country are we visiting from or whatever? I just love it. So what drew you to write this memoir?
So I started this memoir as a private project. I was really sort of writing it for myself. This was before I even had the idea that it might become a book. And I had always wanted to be a writer, but I was writing a novel, and I thought that that's the book that I was going to publish, and that this was really, this project was more something for me to sort of explore the histories of the places where my family came from, the histories of my family. And in some ways, you know, because I grew up sort of straddling all these borders, I had wonderful connections to a lot of different countries, but I never really had a sense of belonging. And I have a very complicated relationship to the idea of home. And then especially because my mother left when I was 2 years old, and so I was primarily raised by my father, kind of moving around. I also didn't have, you know, a deep knowledge of the sort of histories of the places where my parents came from. So the history of Ghana, the history of Armenian people, you know, my family came to America from what was then the Ottoman Empire to escape genocide on the Armenian side of my family. And I knew about that history, but not in a deep sense. And so I had this really strong feeling, you know, I was coming out of a period of depression and anxiety. And I had this strong feeling that what I needed was a different story, a new story that sort of connected me to all of the places that I have belonged to in complicated ways. And that I could sort of narrate myself closer to the to my family and to those places. And so that's sort of how it started. And then years later, I kind of went back to some of that raw material and asked myself, well, can I make art out of this? You know, I was really struggling to write that novel. I was sort of collapsing under its own weight. And I think it was James Baldwin who said, you know, for writers, there's often a story that you really feel like you need to tell before you can write anything else. And I came to understand that this story was that story for me and that I wouldn't actually be able to write anything else until I had really reckoned with and wrestled with this story.
Yeah, and you actually, earthquake is the metaphor that you're using for the upheavals in your life. And it runs throughout the book. I mean, we're constantly going back to that. So when did you start to think of the things that had happened into your life as aftershocks? Because it's the moment that earthquake hits and, you know, the next day it's like, is it going to be bigger? Is it going to be whatever? Where did the aftershocks thought come in? Because it's just so perfect for the metaphor of what you were going through.
Thank you so much for saying that. I really struggled with finding kind of a structure for the book. And I knew that the book wasn't going to be linear because that's just not how I experienced my life and memories. You know, the way that I moved around, it would be impossible for me to have sort of a straight line kind of narrative that takes you from one point to the other. There is a way that I sort of connect to time differently. Maybe it's also partially because my father is from Africa. And in Africa, time is not a straight line. It's like circles within circles, and the past is present and our ancestors are around us. But so I knew that I was going to write a book that sort of engaged with different notions of time and place. But at the same time, I also knew that I had to give readers enough anchors to kind of hold on to that they would be able to kind of travel through this journey with me. And it took me a really long time to figure that out. It actually took a mentor of mine. I had sent, you know, a version of this manuscript to her. And she said, you know, you write a lot about earthquakes. And I hadn't really sort of acknowledged that there were a lot of earthquakes in the writing. And I think that that sort of connection to earthquakes as a metaphor was something that started when I was 7. My mother, you know, as I said, she left when I was 2. Mm-hmm. And she came to visit my father, my sister and I in Rome to take my sister and I out to lunch. And we hadn't seen her in years. And so I was, you know, this was a confusing time. And I was a child. And, you know, she took us to walk around Rome and then dropped us back at our house and left again. And she happened to arrive on the same day that a catastrophic earthquake struck Armenia. And I remember before my mother arrived, kind of asking my father, because he always listened to the BBC World Service. And so the news was on in the morning and the news of the earthquake was on. And I remember asking him, what are aftershocks? And he said, they're the Earth's delayed reaction to stress. And then later that day, my mother arrived on the same day as an earthquake in the country that sort of is half of my DNA, but I didn't really know because I didn't grow up with my mother's family. And so I think in some ways that metaphor sort of got inside of me. And mm-hmm. I tend to think in seismic terms a lot. And it became kind of a guiding metaphor for my life. And so I was writing about earthquakes without noticing that I was doing it. And I think what worked for me when my mentor pointed it out was that the story of an earthquake is not linear. You know, we don't really understand an earthquake sequence except in retrospect, you know, and that's how I felt about my life story. So sometimes it turns out that what we thought was an earthquake was actually a foreshock, and we have to kind of reshuffle the story. And that was sort of what, how I felt like I was approaching writing this manuscript as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And the book actually opens when you're seven and your mother is leaving again, like, here, let's have a great day here. Go back to your father. Blah, blah, blah. And we're going on with our lives. Did your father talk to you about your mother abandoning your lives? Like, how did he handle that with you? That, I mean, for your seven, first of all, you have a very in-depth explanation of what an earthquake is. It's not just that the earth shook. It gives you something very in-depth. But then mom leaves again. What is he telling you about this? Is he protecting you or her?
Yeah. So, you know, my father always spoke to my sister and I kind of as though we were grown-ups from when we were very young. That was just the kind of person that he was. But yes, he was protecting us in some ways. He would answer our questions and he would answer them truthfully. But looking back on it, I could see how he didn't want me to close myself off to the possibility of a different relationship with my mother in the future. And so even that day, you know, he was very angry. And I kind of overheard him talking to my stepmother about, oh, how can she only show up for one day? You know, this is terrible. These are her children. But to me, like when he was talking to me, he always left open the possibility that there was, that things might change in the future. And, you know, when I asked him why she left, which I, you know, I did several times as a child, and he would always sort of say, she thought that you were better off with me. Or he would, at one point, I asked him that question and he told me, you know, she has a lot of trauma in her blood. And I think that's why she left. She wasn't ready to be your mother, but sort of left the door open that, you know, things would change in the future. And I've come to understand that. And in the writing of the book, I've come to understand that in some ways, my father was sort of speaking to epigenetic inheritance and the ways that people do carry trauma in our bodies. And, you know, my mother came from a family who had lost everything. Her great grandparents survived, my great grandparents survived a genocide and came to America after sort of a series of catastrophes, trying to find a place to seek exile, and finally found their way to America, but carried a lot of trauma. You know, my grandmother's mother was orphaned and, you know, was in an orphanage in Armenia, and then was brought to America to be a wife very young. And so I think that that's sort of what he was speaking to and wanted me to be open to sort of exploring the ways in which we all kind of carry trauma, and that maybe my mother was doing the best that she could.
Yeah, it wasn't like she was trying hard not to be kind to you. It wasn't emotionally available to her. That's what I felt like I was hearing. You know, before reading the book, I knew your dad had passed away, but I didn't realize you were so young when it happened. You were 13 or 14. Am I right that it took you a long time to process his death?
Yeah. So, you know, my father, for all sorts of reasons, was the great hero of my life. I think probably in part because my mother left and he was sort of the parent who was in my life. He was mother and father. And also because he was just this sort of brilliant, funny, kind person. And, you know, he taught me so much. Much of my worldview is based on his worldview, which very much was engaged with how we can love and be connected to each other in deep ways. And, you know, that was in the work that he chose to do. And it was in the way he sort of educated my sister and I. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it took me a really long time to sort of come to terms with the fact that I had lost him. And I didn't want to kind of look directly at that grief for a really long time. And actually, it was through this period where I was sort of writing this material for myself, in a way that was sort of the moment that I paused to really grieve. And what I actually discovered was that on the other side of that grief that I had been so scared to connect with was my deep love for my father. Mm-hmm. And so writing about grief in some ways kind of brought him back to me and allowed me to sort of reconnect with the relationship that we had.
You know, I would have loved to have met your father from the way you introduced him in the book. And doing some research for this interview, I actually saw pictures of him and I saw a smiling face with you and whatever. And it was just really lovely because he was a big personality in a lot of ways. He was a very big personality. He like owned the room when he walked in the room. But also with you was such a kind father, and he was so supportive of what you were doing. It was, you know, the blend of both was there on the page.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it was really important to me to try and sort of capture his spirit on the page so that others could sort of encounter him. And in some ways, that was my way of honoring him.
Yeah. And then your stepmother later told you something about your father's death that she sort of sprung on you. Like, there would purport another shockwave your way. I mean, I'm just going to say, like, you know, this, what was that like for you? That, you know, she says, this is not really how he died. This is really what was going on. And I didn't understand, first of all, why she needed to do it. And second of all, what the impact is at this point on a child that, like, oh no, that's not really, and you're, it's tenuous enough as it is, because you're young enough as it is. And then to flip that around.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a question that I'm still wrestling with myself. And I think that I will be for a while, for a long time, maybe my whole life. But so, yeah, so I think what you're speaking to is that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I was living in New York City, and my stepmother, who actually, I will say, like, to her credit, after my father passed away, my mother was still not ready to be a mother to my sister and I. And my stepmother did step up and say, mm-hmm. you know, girls, you can continue to live with me. We did already have a very sort of tenuous, shaky relationship, a roller coaster relationship in a lot of ways. And yet at the same time, there was love there, you know, mm-hmm. underneath it. But I think that she also really struggled with my father's death. Mm-hmm. And the sort of shape of our relationship was set up by petty jealousies. You know, we were both vying, you know, me as a child and her as a woman who had married a man with two daughters, who for a long time had been his world, sort of vying for his attention. And that sort of shaped our relationship in some ways. And then when I was 18, I moved to New York for college. And she came to New York City, and we got into an argument. It was not over anything important. But out of that argument, she suddenly said, you know, your father did not die of cancer, which was what I had always believed. He died of AIDS. And that sort of set me off into sort of a real reckoning and like a period of deep depression and anxiety, because in some ways the story that I had told myself about my father, the story I knew of him, and this idea that I was like a very important person in his life to whom he would have told everything, you know, so to hear that sort of really shook me. Mm-hmm. And I had to sort of examine myself as to why should that matter? You know, why does it matter if he died of cancer or of AIDS? And ultimately, I decided that it doesn't matter, and that I, you know, I don't know if it's true or not to this day, but I sort of decided that it doesn't matter, because what matters is that, you know, he was a parent who deeply loved my sister and I. But the question as to why she revealed it that way, I still don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's something that I am trying to write toward understanding of in the book as well.
Yeah. And it, at the same time, you take on this caretaking role for your siblings as well, because they came to you with their needs. So you're suffering from your own aftershocks. And when they're struggling, you're struggling to cope on your own, but they're coming to you as well. And I thought that they brought their own aftershocks to your event. It's like, okay, we want to make a bigger earthquake. Let's have them come on there as well. Am I right? And that was what was going on. It was like, nobody was coming and saying, Nadia, everything's okay. Come on over for dinner. It's more like, Nadia, I need money. Can you help me? Nadia, am I right?
Yeah, you know, I'm the eldest, and my sister and I are very close. She's a year younger than me, but I've always very much been the older sister. And my father also really emphasized, and especially when he was dying, you know, he really emphasized to me that he expected me to be there for them and to take care of them, because I was the eldest, and that was sort of my role in the family. And so I took that very seriously, but at the same time, like, I can't pretend that I didn't sometimes resent it. Mm-hmm. And so there were moments where, you know, I felt like my siblings needed more than I had to give them, because I was still sort of reckoning with my own aftershocks, you know, at the same time as they were sort of dealing with theirs. And so that is part of the story too. But But yeah, there's a deep connection and love between my siblings and I, and you know, like any other siblings, we also have our disagreements and fights, but it is really important to me to show up for them even when I feel sort of this resentment at like, why me? Why do I have to solve all the problems?
Can't you just figure it out yourself this time? I have finals. I have this. I have that. And it's always people, when people really need you, it always does seem to come at the worst possible moment. It's just, they're like, wait a second. I have a paper due tomorrow. I've got this, that, the other thing. And can you? And it's like, okay. You know, identity is something you grapple with a lot in Aftershocks. And you refer to yourself as a third culture kid. So tell me what that means to you. What's a third culture kid?
So a third culture kid is like when you were a child that you grew up outside of your parents' cultures. And so that, you know, that can mean any number of things. You know, many immigrants might see themselves as third culture kids. But I think it has especially, the phrase has especially been adopted by people like me who have sort of nomadic childhoods, whether that's because your parents work for the UN or for embassies and you really don't have sort of a place to call home. And some of the things that sort of connect us, you know, those of us who kind of identify with the third culture identity, is that, you know, we have this deep sense of, or at least I do, have this deep sense of gratitude for the way that I grew up and the fact that I got to see so much of the world and in such meaningful ways that you wouldn't get if you don't live in the place, you know, just mm-hmm. by traveling. And, you know, it also gave me this deep knowledge that, you know, supremacy is not real, that there's so much that connects us and binds us in the responsibilities that we have toward each other across the world. But at the same time, we grow up with a deep longing for to belong, you know, and just mm-hmm. as we're settling into a country and learning the language and making friends, you know, we have to prepare to leave. And, you know, with my background, there were times too when I felt like an outsider in my own family. You know, I don't speak my father's language, Cree. And because I'm Black, when I was visiting my mom in Massachusetts, some people assumed that I was adopted. Mm-hmm. And there was often this demand, you know, that, you know, you see your identity as fixed, or people will ask you where you're from. And then I have to kind of chart out this really complicated journey. And then people kind of look at you funny and like are not sure if you can be trusted. And I think now more people understand identity and race as sort of specious. But, you know, growing up, there was always this sense of, okay, who am I expected to be in this moment? And sort of, how do I answer this question of where am I from? You know, it's a complicated question for me.
Where was my second grade picture from? Oh, maybe it was Uganda. Oh, where was I? And you're constantly having to make new friends wherever you go as well. It's, you know, getting uprooted as a child is something where every single time you have to go in and you're to figure out what everybody's wearing. You have to figure out what everybody's talking about. And you're in a different country each time. And yes, you are with embassy kids or you are with, you know, people, but it's still not the same. It's still like, I have to get to know everybody. So you're constantly reinventing yourself as you go on to each of these different places. And I loved saying that when you were in some schools, people assumed you were American, but at other times I did love that you affected accents according to like where you were. And you can turn on a British accent, like, you know, quite quickly to adapt yourself to where you were. But I feel like you were longing for identity. And so am I right? That's what was happening?
Yeah. I mean, so the thing is, I have had many accents. So I am told that when I first started to speak English, you know, my mother is American, but I didn't live here until I was 18. So I'm a US citizen, but it doesn't feel quite truthful to say that, you know, I'm American without adding all of the additional places, you know, although I've lived in New York all of my adult life. And so I definitely feel like this is home in many ways. But like all of my other homes, you know, it's a complicated relationship that I have to home. But so, yeah, I'm told that when I first started to speak that I had sort of a Tanzanian accent because that's where we were living at the time. And that's how I heard English spoken around me. And my father had a Ghanaian accent, an African accent. So I had sort of a mixed up kind of African accent. But then when my father for a few years sent my sister and I to live with his older sister in the mm-hmm. UK. And so I lived with my Auntie Harriet in England and went to an English nursery school and kindergarten and first grade. and developed a British accent. And that was the accent that I spoke in until I was around 9 or 10 years old. And then I started going to American schools in Africa, just to complicate things, but where all of the teachers were American. So my accent shifted, but I still had access to my British accent. And so when I went to boarding school later in England, I was able to kind of move back and forth between accents. And, you know, people call that code switching. It's not unique to third culture kids. Many people who grow up around many cultures have access to different voices. And, you know, I've tried to think about, there are ways in which code switching, when it's sort of imposed on you and you feel like this is how I'm expected to show up, and so mm-hmm. you feel forced to kind of move into a voice that's not your own, that can be harmful. But on the other hand, I've come to a place where I really celebrate my ability to shift in and out of voices and to code switch, because those voices are all part of who I am mm-hmm. In a lot of ways. And so now, you know, I used to get accused if I was tired, you know, of placing too hard an emphasis on my T's and why are you doing a British accent? But, and it used to sort of worry me, like, oh no, what are people thinking? But now I kind of celebrate that, you know, I do come from many places mm-hmm. and many voices and many languages.
And, you know, I'm thinking you went to live with your aunt when you were in kindergarten, first and second grade. And that was about the time your mother blasted back into your life for just a little while and then go on from there. It was a lot. It was a lot when you were growing up. In case anybody hasn't told you, this is a lot. This is not your normal childhood. You know? Yeah. Do you feel like you finally have found identity? Do you feel like you're finally there, or are you still working on it?
I think that I'll always be working on it, because I think my identity will always be fluid. But I think where I have landed that feels important and meaningful to me is that I now do define home and family really expansively. And mm-hmm. I used to be so concerned with, like, can I say that I'm Tanzanian, you know, because I was born in Tanzania. I have a Tanzanian stepmother, and I do speak some Swahili, passable Swahili. But does Tanzania really belong to me? And I would have the same questions about Italy. I speak fluent Italian. I lived in Italy for a very long time. But I remember when I moved to the States, and there are a lot of Italian Americans, and I would be like, can I really say that I'm also Italian in some ways? And even with the places where, you know, where my parents are from, like Armenia, how Armenian am I? You know, how Ghanaian am I, mm-hmm. having not lived there? But now I do claim all of those places and all of those peoples, and, you know, I claim them because I love them. Like, my love for them makes them mine in some ways. And I think my relationship to them will always be complicated, but I'm sort of in a place where I celebrate those complications. It just means that I get to have more homes than a lot
more of homes. Yeah. I like that line. That's really great. I got to have more homes. You know, I was even thinking, when you're in college, it's 9/11 and you come up out of the subway and the towers are falling, and you talk about a real aftershock of your life, of what's going on and whatever. And it's, you're alone in a lot of ways. It's not like you had family here that you could go to or whatever. And it's that, I remember how shocking that day was on a normal level for people, let alone, and I'd lived here in the metropolitan area my whole life. Our office was in New York. But for you, it was like another upheaval. It was like a complete, you know, different kind of a thing. Can you talk to that a little bit about, did that have a huge impact on you, even though you've been all over the world and seen conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I think I know that it definitely did. And I think, like many of my griefs that I tried for a very long time to sort of be okay and not sort of look at it directly, and life went on, you know, I was in college at the time, as you say, and I didn't really have family in America at that time. And I came out of, I was at Pace University, which is right near the Twin Towers. And so I was on my way to class, and I got out of the subway, and this was before people really knew what was going on. You know, the first plane had hit the tower, but nobody was stopping anyone from coming out of the subway, because at that point it could have still been an accident. So I came out of the subway, and, you know, everyone was looking up, and I remember looking up and seeing the towers on fire. And then I was, the second plane hit, and I was one of those people sort of on the news that you saw in the news footage, sort of running covered in ash. And I walked all the way to Times Square that day because I didn't know what was happening, but I just wanted to get far away from where I was. And yeah, in some ways, what I realized is that running, like the earthquake that arrived with my mother, that running from the burning towers and the falling towers kind of crept inside of me and did become sort of another way that I sort of understood the disasters of my life and sort of made connections between them and this fear that there was always going to be another disaster, more shaking, more falling buildings, you know, mm-hmm. Sort of looking around me. And I think that ultimately all of those things combined, the other wars that I lived through, you know, we lived in Ethiopia during a civil war for my father's work. And in many ways we were protected, but still I was very aware that there was a lot of violence kind of around us. And similarly, when we lived in Uganda, it was during a time of war as well. The Lord's Resistance Army was sort of wreaking havoc on the north of the country, abducting children. And I remember, you know, hearing all of those stories around me and then sort of living through 9/11 and all of these disasters, you know, private and seismic disasters kind of combining in me. And finally, sort of in my 20s, finally, I paused and sort of allowed myself to feel the weight of all of that. Mm-hmm. The abandonments, the disasters, the war.
Yeah, because it's all like around you and you're going to class, studying for exams, doing this, working multiple jobs, doing everything. It's like, it's about survival, but at the same time, everything else is like swirling around on the outside. Mm-hmm. You know, race and conversation about race has ramped up over the last year. Is being Black in America different from how you feel you're seen in the rest of the world? Because you've lived a lot of different places.
Yeah, I mean, I think being Black and Blackness is defined differently everywhere. You know, there are different kinds of relationships that people have to Blackness. I think that anti-Blackness is a global phenomenon built on sort of colonization and enslavement and the justification for those things. And so anti-Blackness does exist everywhere, but it takes on different forms, you know, it takes on different forms and different textures depending on where you are. And so, you know, I have been Black all my life and, you know, and I realized that I was sort of seen as a different kind of person depending on where I was and where I was living. You know, for example, when we lived in Ethiopia, that was one of the few places where people would look at me and sort of think that I came from there. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was not considered Black in Ethiopia because a lot of Ethiopians don't consider themselves Black. They consider themselves something else, Ethiopian. And at the same time, my father was considered Black in Ethiopia. And so that was sort of a confusing time for me too as a child, because I was always raised to be very proud of my Blackness. And I was looking around me at people who were saying that they weren't Black, but looked very much like me. And then, you know, being Black in Europe is also in the UK, where I was one of few Black children at the schools that I went to. And of course, there is a history of colonization of the African continent in the UK. And so what that means in terms of the connections between class and race were, I was aware of them as a child in very complicated ways. Like I didn't understand them fully, but I was aware that, you know, class and Blackness and colonization, that there were connections there. But I think, you know, I moved here to America when I was 18. And a big part of my coming of age was coming to understand the racial arrangement in America and my place in it. And it was very quickly clear to me that race and racism do shape a lot of American life. You know, it's baked into a lot of the systems, whether that's where people get to live or where people get to go to school. And that's, you know, those are historic systems that were developed with racist thinking intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that now the movement that you're speaking to is sort of all of us asking ourselves, how do we undo this? Mm-hmm. And how can we create systems that are more inclusive and more fair and address sort of anti-Blackness and racism in all of its forms?
Yeah, and at the same time, your brother has very different experiences than you have. Your brother has that feeling of be very careful when you leave the house. I remember one friend saying that she never felt safe when her children were not in the house. And how did that impact you seeing what was happening to him, because you're not moving through the world quite the same way as he is.
That's right. You know, I think my brother moved here. He's 8 years younger than me, and he moved here for university. He's my half brother. So, you know, he is a dark skinned black man. And the way that the world engaged with him here was so counter to his sense of self, having grown up kind of in an international community. And suddenly when he arrived in New York, sort of during the height of the stop and frisk policy, mm-hmm. and found himself often sort of under suspicion, just for sort of walking around in his own neighborhood. He lived on the Upper East Side and was stopped multiple times by the police for going into his own apartment. And that was deeply confusing to him. He didn't understand why just the fact of his body in a place would lead the police to sort of question him and sort of question his right to be there. And it was deeply traumatic for him. And so, I didn't have those experiences because mm-hmm. I'm a woman, maybe because I'm petite, because I'm not a man. And so seeing sort of racism through his experience also kind of cemented my understanding that, you know, this country has come so far, and in many ways, you know, has made sort of a lot of important changes in terms of policy, but at the same time, there is still a lot that we together need to undo.
It's the shades of blackness that are still being looked at. Your brother still looks more black, and it just is, it's something we do need to work on. Yeah, I would completely concur. You know, home is something that defines us. And when you think of home, is it where you are now? Is it home? Are you home?
I do think of Brooklyn, as my home. You know, I have lived in New York my entire adult life. Mm-hmm. I moved here when I was 18, and I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else at this point. And so I do sort of claim New York, America, Brooklyn as my home in a lot of ways. And I think, I also allow myself to kind of look at the other places where I've come from as home too. So when I go to Ghana now, you know, I actually, my brother moved to Ghana actually and got married and had a son. And so when I go there to visit him and see my grandparents, my grandmother, I also think of that as going home, which is interesting because I also didn't grow up in Ghana, you know? And so I think our relationship to home sort of shifts as we get older and sort of develop new relationships to places that we might not have expected before.
You know, New York is your American home. New York can be your American home. You can have other world homes. You know, there's a blue chair that figures into this book, and we've got to talk about the blue chair. The blue chair is the name of different chapters or whatever. So tell us a little bit about the blue chair and your relationship to it.
Yeah, sure. So the blue chair sort of came into my life during this period where I knew that I was running away from all of these griefs that I've carried in my body for a very long time. And then my stepmother sort of arriving and revealing this secret or lie about my father that then caused me to question the entire story that I had sort of built for myself in order to survive, which was really the foundation of that story was my relationship with my father. And I had in some way sort of made a deity out of my father, and she was putting that into question. And so I started to feel all of those tremors, all of those aftershocks in that moment. And I experienced, you know, what I am comfortable calling it sort of a mental breakdown. Mm-hmm. But I found myself increasingly unable to go out into the world. You know, I've always been someone who has been very striving. And as you said, I was working, you know, I was in graduate school. I was working three jobs. I had always been someone who was determined to sort of put my head down and keep plowing forward and keep working. And I found myself unable to continue doing that. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of wandering around New York, purposeless. And I saw this blue chair on the street, you know, as we often do in New York, we see furniture that's sort of left out, and something kind of drew me to this blue chair. And so I went to inspect it, and I found that it was a rocking chair. It was an armchair, but it was also a rocking chair. And we had rocking chairs in every house that I lived in growing up. My father loved rocking chairs. And so something in me just said, I want this chair. I'm not someone who frequently would drag furniture in from the street. But I wanted this chair. And so I picked it up and I carried it home and I put it in my room. And actually the blue chair is where I ended up sort of mostly sitting for 7 days, trying to sort of make meaning of the shaking in my body, the shaking in my life, and sort of trying to tell myself a new story that I could live inside of, because the story that I had been given was no longer habitable for me. And so the blue chair, the 7 days in the blue chair, like the earthquake, is a thread mm-hmm. that kind of ties the book together. Mm-hmm. And those sections, those chapters are sort of written from inside of the breakdown. So I really tried to capture kind of what it felt like to sit in that blue chair and sort of question everything and, you know, try to understand the world around me and everything that had happened in my life, and to find my way outside again, you know, to find my way out of the blue chair, out of my room, and back into the world.
And I feel like you write very candidly about the depression and anxiety that you were going through. Did writing about it take you to a better place right away, or did you still have to work through it?
Still very much had to work through it. I mean, mm-hmm. it definitely was a meaningful it definitely meaningfully helped me mm-hmm. to write about it and to sort of like look at the events of my life through different angles, and to try to sort of, one of the principles that I held in writing what was the private project that became Aftershocks was that my anger was one of the things that was not serving me. It was making me stiff and tense and, you know, unable, the sort of plowing through that wasn't serving me anymore. And one of the things that I sort of was committed to, and I felt like was the only way that I was going to find my way out of the blue chair, was to write myself toward deeper compassion, love, and connection to the people in my life, but also to myself. And I think writing from that principle really helped to open me up and free me, even to the point where finally I was able to sort of reach out to my mother again after a decade-long estrangement to see if there was a possibility of a different kind of relationship with her. So that was definitely part of the process, but I also went to therapy. And it was sort of a many, many years of sort of trying to sort of reckon with the past.
Do you know, there were so many pages that I folded down in this book. Okay, I dog-eared, and it's a galley, everybody. It's not a final book. And I dog-eared this many pages because there were so many things that you were saying on the pages that really gave me pause and made me, and I was going back when I was writing the interview questions, and there was so much in here to discuss as a result of where you were taking us inside with you. So you referenced jazz, especially John Coltrane in the book. What has jazz music meant to you? And I know it has a very personal experience for your life as well right now. So tell us about jazz and you.
Sure. So jazz was in a lot of ways my father's music. You know, my father was he was a big music lover, and, you know, he was from Ghana. And so the Ashanti culture, the culture that he came from, music is so much a part of life. It's so much a part of everyone's everyday experience. It's all around. There are rhythms, drum rhythms, and songs mm-hmm. for everything. There's like a drum rhythm for when a baby is born, a rhythm for the naming of the baby. There's a drum rhythm and a song for washing your clothes. And so everyone, you know, there's music everywhere in Ghana. Ghanaian Ashanti funerals are sort of celebrations of life with drumming and dancing and singing. And so that was, you know, how he grew up. And so was a big music lover, but as well as loving sort of African rhythms and music from, you know, the more traditional drumming to sort of high life music, which is this music from Ghana that eventually grew into Afrobeat, which some people might know. Fela Kuti was sort of one of the great, great artists of that genre. But those genres also kind of pulled freely from jazz. And there was this sort of back and forth between Black American musical expression and African musical expression that sort of tied to this idea of a Pan-African philosophy where Black peoples across the diaspora were connected in so many ways, not just politically, but also artistically and creatively, and feeding off of each other. And so jazz was a big part of my father's life as well. And, you know, John Coltrane was one of his big heroes. And I can remember being a child and He would sort of sit me down and say, listen, you have to listen to this, like, let yourself go. And I was like, this is so much noise. Like, there's so much going on in this music, so much dissonance. And, you know, I didn't understand it as a child. But when I was going through sort of my struggles with anxiety and depression, in some ways, the more avant-garde jazz and, you know, John Coltrane's more avant-garde stuff really connected to me. I went back to that music because it was my father's music in some ways, to see if I could understand it differently as a grown-up. But then also what I found was that it told a story of sort of the world and of our souls in a way that I could now understand. That dissonance made sense to me. And I think what you're speaking to now is that I'm actually married to a jazz musician. I'm married to a jazz saxophonist now.
I just love that. You got married in, what was it, December?
Yeah.
Cool. Middle of a pandemic. Let's go get married. You know, I'm going longer. I'm going to ask one more question just before we go to questions from the audience, because I mean, I could just go on and on chatting with you in case you can't tell. The cover is stunning. Actually, I pulled one down here. Was this always the cover? And I take it this was always the title. This was always the title over here.
Yes.
And the cover?
It was always the title. We went through several covers. And I think at one point we had actually sort of landed and decided on a different cover. But then the one of the editors at Simon & Schuster came back and said, you know, I still don't think that cover is quite right. And then they kind of worked on it for a little bit and came back with this one. And all of us were like, yes, this is definitely the cover. Yeah.
Definitely the cover. I'm going to ask one more about the, you narrated the audiobook yourself. You actually, what was that experience like? And did you always know you were going to narrate the audio, or was that something that came in later?
Yeah, no, I didn't know. I didn't actually know how that worked. You know, this is my first book, so I didn't know how it worked. But they did sort of reach out to me and ask if I would be interested in narrating my own audiobook. And maybe because there are a lot of different phrases in different languages there, and it might have been complicated to find someone who could do all of those things. But it was a great experience in a lot of ways. It like had me sort of connect to the story in a different way, sort of reading it out loud and finding different rhythms and finding, you know, I hadn't read the whole thing for a long time. You know, the editing process, you're going in bits and pieces. And so connecting with it that way was actually sort of a gift to be able to sort of read it out loud and reconnect with some of those memories.
Yeah, it's difficult to do the audiobook though, because many authors have said to me when they go to do their own work, they want to change something. They're like, no, let's change. No, you have to read exactly what's on the page. You can't make it up differently. You know, you can't do something
else. Definitely had those moments where I was like, oh, I found a better word, but it's already
there. You don't have to write what you're doing. Austin is our voice of God. Austin, do you have questions? Or do I keep going?
Yeah, there are quite a few questions.
We'll go.
We'll get to them all. And I'll try not to ask any questions that may have been asked already in the interview. So let's see. The first question comes from an anonymous attendee, and they ask, there are a few questions that are similar to this. Did you develop a relationship with your mother and other family from that side?
Yes, I did. A story that I could tell is that I could tell a story of abandonment, and in some ways Aftershocks is a story of being abandoned by my mother. But at the same time, as I was writing the book, I realized that many of her family members, my grandparents included, you know, my mother's parents, across oceans and across the estrangement with my mother, worked really hard to love me and would send letters and packages and books and clothes and, you know, would sign off every time, we're thinking of you, we're always thinking of you. And so, you know, as I was writing, that sort of softened me to realize that, you know, they had worked really hard to love me. And at the same time, as I was writing, and because I was doing sort of research about the history of the Armenian genocide and what my family went through, and what my mother might have been through, it sort of opened up more compassion in me for her and sort of a desire to see if we could connect in a different way. And so I did end up reaching out to my mother. And now we have a relationship, you know, that I would say is a loving relationship. And it's a choice that we make, you know, that there's still some hard parts. And we sort of wrestle with the difficult things together. And we've had some difficult conversations, but we're choosing to kind of show up and keep trying. And I developed a really strong relationship with her parents, with my grandparents, and was lucky to get to have that relationship with them before they passed away last year. And so yes, I think that that I'm really grateful that the writing of the book sort of helped to open me up to the possibility of relationships with my mother's family.
Mm-hmm. Another attendee asks, do you plan to continue your father's type of work in the world with disadvantaged populations?
I do. That is my career, actually, as well as being a writer. I work in social justice. I've worked for a lot of nonprofits. I worked for 9 years for an organization working on poverty and inequality in American cities. And, you know, I studied urban planning and policy with the intention to go into that kind of work, looking at sort of how to connect people to opportunities and how to sort of reckon with history and the ways that that policies are created in order to open up more opportunity for everyone. And so that was my job for 9 years. And I just started a new job now, actually working with a Black-owned consulting firm that is working with foundations and nonprofits to sort of do all sorts of social impact work. So yes, that's a big part of my life as well.
And so what do you see, Beth asks, what do you see is next for either your writing or more broadly? And I would connect that into it. Where do you see that going next?
So for my writing, I'm working on a couple of projects now, and it's very early days, so I'm not going to say too much about them, except to say that one, I think, wants to be an essay collection, and another one wants to be a novel, but we'll see where those go. I'm sort of doing research and reading and a little bit of notes and writing some scenes for both of those. And then, you know, I just started this new job and am very excited to kind of see where it takes me. But I think that working in communities and in partnership with communities and in service of social justice will always be a big part of my life as well.
Joseph asked what style you're most comfortable writing with. And that's kind of a broad question, but, you know, you mentioned essays and novel writing and you have this memoir.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a style that I'm most comfortable with. I usually write from from kind of two places. One is that I write to understand what I think and to connect to deeper understanding around big questions that I'm carrying. And I think the form often sort of presents itself. And so that's when I said, you know, this project wants to be a collection of essays. Maybe it will turn out to be something else, but I think it's the questions that guide me and that guide the form. I've also written sort of a lyric essay chapbook. I've written some short stories, but yeah, I think it's sort of wherever the question takes me is sort of that sort of guides the form. And then I also write from a place of language. And so if I'm stuck, I sort of take it sentence by sentence and I pay a lot of attention to the rhythm of language. And that also is something that guides me in all of my writing. But I can move pretty fluidly between fiction and nonfiction and I love both genres. So I think that I will continue to sort of experiment with form.
Great. Well, we want to have more from you. So,
Thank you.
Beth asks, if you wrote part two or part three of your memoir, where would you want to see it go next?
Yeah. So, I mean, in some ways, the project, you know, again, I'm not going to speak too much about it because who knows what it'll end up being. But the nonfiction project that I'm working on now, it doesn't exactly pick up where Aftershocks left off, but the questions that were opened up in Aftershocks about sort of questions like grace and connection and family and compassion, like those are Those are questions that I'm continuing to write toward in this next project, and like really asking myself, like, and even thinking about sort of my social justice work, kind of asking myself, like, how can we be in better community with each other? How can I continue to work on myself so that I am a more compassionate, open person? And yeah, so that's sort of, I think, the next phase in my nonfiction work.
And that sounds great. I think that's something that we all need more of always. Somebody asked, are there any books that we should read that complement your memoir?
So many. A few memoirs that I've really loved. So one that I actually was thinking about recently, because I was sort of writing a roundup of books that engage with questions of roots. And, you know, that's definitely a question that I'm deeply engaged with, you know, people either sort of writing toward finding their roots or people trying to kind of deracinate themselves from their roots. Like, I'm interested in both kinds of writing. And so one is Sarah Broom's memoir, The Yellow House, which is both a history of her family and a history of her family's house in sort of a long neglected neighborhood of New Orleans. And so in some ways, it's also a history of New Orleans. And so I love the way that she sort of moves back and forth between sort of the private story of her life, but then also a deeper engagement with the history of her hometown. So I think that that's definitely one that I would recommend. Survival Math by Mitchell Jackson, I think, is another memoir that works similarly, sort of looking at questions around sort of his family and masculinity in his family, some history of Portland where he's from, and sort of race in America. He's another kind of Black memoirist. And then, you know, I sort of think of myself as having sort of a council of mother writers, of whom sort of Toni Morrison, Audre Lorde, Toni Cade Bambara are all part of that. And so I would definitely suggest sort of reconnecting to their work as well.
What questions do you wish people would ask you that they don't?
You know,
or that they haven't yet?
I think that I actually have been so thrilled with the kinds of questions that I've been getting. I think, you know, this is my first book, so I didn't know what to expect, but I think that people's engagement has been so lovely and so generous. And so I've been really, I don't know that I can speak to a question that I haven't been asked. I think people have really asked thoughtful questions that, you know, that caused me to kind of look at things differently. And so I'm really happy with the conversations I've had.
Abby asks, is it painful when people who have read your work discuss the personal pain with you? Is it difficult to revisit that?
It can be sometimes, but I think much of what I feel is a sense of sort of joy and pride in how far I've come, and like hopefulness that other people who have gone through similar things can connect to my story and see themselves in my story, even if the particularities of their life might be different. There are lots of ways that lots of people sort of struggle with questions of identity and home and mental health issues. And so I actually have been very grateful to be able to talk about these issues that I think, you know, for far too long, too many of us have carried shame around. And so kind of freeing myself from that by talking to people about it, it can be painful at times, but a lot of the time it continues to sort of push me and free me and connect me to other people.
Reza asks, do you still have that blue chair or have you given it away?
So I had it for several years after, I sort of got up out of it. But when I left Chinatown, so I was living in Chinatown, New York at the time, of the blue chair. And when I left Chinatown, I decided to leave it out on the street and let it have a new life, potentially in another home, that it had served me well, but I no longer needed it.
So would you just circle the block and come back and see if it was still there? Because that's about how long it takes to go.
Yeah, exactly. It was gone pretty soon. I think I went back upstairs, had lunch, came down, and it was gone.
My son went to Fordham in the city, and they said, if you need furniture, just go to the Upper East Side the day before garbage day, and that's where you get your furniture. It was very
that's
funny.
That's probably where the good furniture is, yeah.
We just got questions in. Meredith asks, what would you say to others dealing with similar trauma or just trauma in general And what was the most transformative story from somebody else for you?
Sorry, can you say the first part again?
Yes. What would you say to others dealing with similar trauma or trauma in general?
I would say be kind to yourself. You know, I think the biggest challenge that I had was, you know, as I said, I sort of tried to plow right through it and not feel it. And the reality is that your body is processing it and feeling it, whether or not you're willing to acknowledge and accept that. And so sort of being kind to yourself, allowing yourself to slow down and allowing yourself to feel your grief and trauma and to sort of examine it, that sort of was really meaningful to me. That's where the change began to happen for me. And, you know, to reach out to other people and connect to other people, which I think kind of goes to the second part of the question, which is like, what is one of the best stories that you've heard from someone else. So I actually heard recently from a woman who emailed me to basically say that she had a similar sort of relationship with her mother, and that she had actually reached out to her mother after a long estrangement, and that now she sees her mother kind of as one of her best friends, and not that the relationship isn't complicated, but and that they continue to sort of have to work on things, but that she like actually has found that she likes herself better after offering that grace. And so that was something that I really could connect to, and really appreciated her sort of reaching out to me.
Wow. I think we're out of time, so I'll just ask one last question from Joanne. What are your feelings about motherhood? Do you think that's something that you would want to be? And just what are your personal feelings? She says, I hope that's not too personal to ask. Thank you.
No, it's okay. I don't know. I mean, the honest answer to that question is I don't know. It's a question that I will continue to look at and think about. But yeah, I'm comfortable in my place of not knowing at this moment.
Great. Well, I think that's everything.
Nadia, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so glad to finally be able to put the conversation with you in touch with the book, because I was completely mesmerized reading the book and I wanted to see the person behind it and get to know her better. And I thank you for sharing that with the whole audience today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks everyone for your thoughtful questions. This was great.
Yes. So on behalf of Morristown Festival Books, thanks to Nadia. And we hope you enjoyed the conversation this afternoon. Please support these authors by buying their books at the official bookseller Bookends, linked on the Morristown Festival of Books website. And on behalf of the Morristown Festival of Books, we would like to thank you, Morgan Stanley Private Wealth Management, the Community Foundation of New Jersey, Delta Dental, Investors Bank, Morris Arts, Red Hook Management Invested Advisors, and the William E. Simon Foundation for their festival sponsorship. Thank you again, and save the date for the Fall Festival, October 8th and 9th, 2021. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue.